Did you ever get any explanation?
Welcome to the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs, Episode 5. I'm Josh Durham.
And I'm Ashley Pace.
Our podcast is the story of the 1990 Burlington Indians, one of the greatest teams that Burlington has ever had in terms of future major league talent. And our jobs working for the team that summer, well, they were among the greatest jobs we've ever had.
Our podcast is a way for us to walk down memory lane 3 decades later with the players and staff from that team. It's also a way to find out whether I, Ashley Pace, the team's bat boy, cost Frank Monastero his professional baseball career.
As you heard at the end of Episode 3, and again at the end of Episode 4, we've had the chance to catch up with Frank.
We have indeed.
When Ashley and I first started talking about this project a few years ago, we tried reaching out to Frank back then. We left a message for him at the baseball academy where he worked, but we never got a return phone call.
Once we really got it going and we released a couple of episodes, we tried reaching out again.
And that's when you heard from him?
I sure did. I sent an email and he called me back.
How did that call go?
We kept it short because I wanted you to be in on the call too. I did explain to him what we were doing and asked if he'd be up for an interview. And he was really thrilled and said he was. So we lined up the call and made it happen.
Before we get to the hot dog incident, though, which Frank definitely remembered, let's remind our listeners how it was that Frank Monastero got to Burlington. He was drafted from Westchester University in Pennsylvania in the summer of 1990. He was Cleveland's last pick that year in the 59th round. But a scout for the Cleveland Indians had led Frank to believe he'd go a lot higher.
I was in Florida. Westchester was in Florida doing like our spring training, getting ready to come back up north and, you know, play our season. So we were down playing in, I forget what part of Florida. Might have been, was it Jacksonville? Something like that. But anyway, Bobby Mulkmus, he was watching us take batting practice and take infield practice. And then right before the game was about to start, he comes into the dugout with a folder for me and says to me, "We're going to draft you the first day of the draft." And that could be, I mean, it wasn't, you know, the first few rounds. It was the later rounds, first day. That's what he had said to me. So when that day came around and I had, the phone wasn't ringing, I figured, all right, well, I guess they passed up on me. I'm not going to get drafted. And then that was a Monday night. And then that Wednesday is when I got that phone call, like the last day of the draft. So I wasn't asking any questions why I didn't go Monday. I'm just like, hey, I don't care where. And they're like, yeah, don't care where you're going. Just you're going down. I'm like, all right.
Frank went to Cleveland first to work out at the big league ballpark, which was Municipal Stadium back then. Frank told us it was a bit of an adjustment for him going into the pros.
It was tough for me. I remember, I believe we spent a week at Municipal Stadium first, after we got drafted, before we went to our cities. And there was a front office guy, or might have just, yeah, he was a front office guy. He might have been in uniform. His name was Johnny Goyle, older man. And I was taking my fungos at second base, and he was roaming around the field and everything. And he came up to me. I remember this. He came up to me and goes, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm good." And he said, he looked at me again. I mean, he looked right at me. He goes, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm good." He goes, "No, you're not. You're homesick." and he was right. And I remember saying to him, I said, "You're exactly right." He goes, "I can tell your body language." He goes, "That's okay. You'll get used to it." And you're talking, I was 21 at the time, so I couldn't imagine an 18-year-old.
Fungos, by the way, are the special kind of bat that coaches hit ground balls and fly balls with during warm-ups. They sound like a good snack food, though. Anyway, after Cleveland, Frank went to Greensboro, and Big Dave Keller was there to pick him up at the airport and drive him to Burlington. Keller apparently laid down the law right off the bat.
He picked me up from the airport. So I got in his car. We're driving to, I think we were driving to the stadium or something like that. And then just small talk, you know, I'm like, you know, I wear number 23. I wear number 23 and on my uniform. And he looked at me and said, "You have no shot at that. That's my number." So, like I said, he was dry. It was a dry sense of humor, but he was funny. And he was enormous. He was a big muscle head. He was a big dude who was very athletic. I remember. So I'm thinking, man, I ain't going to tangle with him. He's he can hurt you and he's quick.
When Frank got to Burlington and settled in at his apartment, he feasted like a king. No, not really. More like a poor college student.
So what I remember probably most is we all started out in some kind of an apartment complex for a week until they got our housing situated. And I remember getting up, going to the ballpark, and I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm a professional baseball player. And I remember my breakfast being a can of Pepsi and a Snickers before I got to the ballpark. And I'm thinking, what in the heck is this?
You've heard us talk in this podcast how Burlington has loved its baseball over the years and really supported it. You've heard the players even describe that. But Frank, well, he had a story for us that's a bit of an outlier.
At the beginning of the season, the team held a couple of meet and greets around town, where the team would show up at a restaurant and greet fans and sign autographs. They do that kind of stuff in the major leagues too, but it's generally just one player making an appearance, maybe two. This is the beauty of the rookie leagues, though. You can get the whole team there. But it doesn't mean they're going to get swarmed by adoring fans.
And then I remember going to an Applebee's, and we were all there as a club. And the Applebee's manager, you know, announced that we were there, feel free to come up and get autographs. Not one person got up. Not one person came to us. We thought we would get swarmed, you know, professional baseball players, blah, blah, blah. And not one person came to our section to get an autograph.
Breakfast, Applebee's, a bag of Fungos. We seem to be detouring into food again.
Yes. Yes, we are.
So why don't we get to the hot dogs then? This is, after all, the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the hot dogs.
All right, let's do it.
When we talked to Frank, we asked him if he'd listened to the podcast at all. We were pretty nervous to hear what he thought.
I imagine that's some kind of surprise, like, what in the world is this all about, and why am I connected with this?
Yeah, because I'm so far, like I said, I'm 51 years old, and I don't, you know, think about things like this podcast. I mean, for me just to get on here now, I had to get my my administration at the academy to help me get on. So I'm not very tech savvy right now. So I need my daughter had to explain to me what you guys were doing.
Have you had a chance to listen to the to any of the episodes?
Yeah, I did. I listened to the first one. It was great.
That was definitely a relief.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I was pretty happy he didn't start cursing us there.
And here's what he remembers about the great hot dog incident of 1990.
Because I use that story. Like I said, I got like 150-some kids that play in my academy, and they're always looking, you know, how, well, you played professional ball, you got any stories? And I always did tell, because I thought that was great, that how I got the hot dogs from you guys gave it to me, no big deal. Then Dave turned around, because he was always had one foot on the step watching the game in the dugout, and then I guess he had smelled the hot dogs and looked back at me and said, I think that at the time it was like $25 a hot dog. I said, well, I'm not playing tonight. Why am I in trouble? He goes, because you didn't get me any.
Hold on. What?
Yeah, I know, right?
That doesn't make any sense.
It really makes zero sense.
There's no denial there. There's no need to come up with an alternative story. There's no need to go into Dave Keller's office to testify about it.
I couldn't figure this all out, so I basically had to ask him, are you sure?
My memory was, like, after kind of all went down, Dave asked me to come into his office, and I'm pretty sure you were in there. And he was asking about the hot dogs. And, you know, we'd come up with this whole, you know, I called them Franks because they're hot dogs, you know, that kind of, you know, do you remember that?
I don't. I don't remember that part. I don't.
I even asked him, are you sure?
I'm troubled by this hot dog story because it sounds like a completely different episode to me than what you and I each remember. I mean, what we had recalled was there had to have been some sort of denial because we were needing to come up with an excuse to get you out of it. But it sounds like what you've described is the hot dogs were in your hands when you're talking with Keller about it.
Yeah, I remember I was eating them, and then he turned to me, and that's when he said, he goes, enjoy them. They're 25. I said, well, I'm not playing tonight. You told me. And he says, yeah, but I'm upset you didn't get me any. That's he was upset that I didn't ask you guys. Oh, by the way, get Dave a couple.
As Frank gave his version of events, I was thinking, how in the world do we reconcile his version with ours? And what occurred to me seemed to make a lot of sense. Frank must have been describing something earlier in the season. And then when Frank got caught later in the season, that must be what Ashley and I have described. And that event must have pushed Keller over the edge. And Frank was trying to get out of that one. At this point, though, he's told us the story twice, but I had to ask him yet again.
As we recall, Ashley got caught coming down the corridor. Keller pops out like he's lying in wait for him. Says, whose are those? Ashley being, you know, 16 and all of 90 pounds dripping wet, confronted by Big Dave Keller, cracks and says, they're Frank's. But then the next day, we're trying to spin it, and Ashley gets called in to testify in Keller's office about the whole exchange. And Keller says, all right, when I asked you, whose are those, you know, what did you tell me? And Ashley said, no, I thought you told me, what are those? And I said, they're Frank's.
I remember him not laughing, but he had that smirk on his face. And, you know, he explained to me why I'm getting fined because I didn't get him any. That's what the exchange was in the dugout.
Yeah, the same story three times. And this is troubling, too. In his version, Frank said he remembers being fined, but he paid it.
Oh, yeah. We paid a fine, yep. There was a few things that you did wrong you got fined for. And one of them was if your group was coming in to hit, you had to go the roundabout way. You couldn't cut through the infield. If you did, you got fined. So there was a few different, you know, and they were fun. It was all in fun, too. I mean, $25 wasn't a big deal. I think I paid it because I was getting more money. My family was sending me money from home. So I think I just paid it.
I'm so confused.
Well, maybe you know, maybe you don't. Doesn't much matter either way.
Let's take a break from this. What we know for certain is that after Frank was sent down to the Gulf Coast League, okay, really after Jim Thome left, the Indians didn't do all that great.
With Thome's departure and Darryl Whitmore's departure, as well as a few other players who moved up, they still had talent on that team, though. Guys like Tracy Sanders. Remember, he was the guy who was drafted in the 58th round, and he signed for a 6-cent roast beef and a Coke at Subway, according to Tony Tillman. A Burlington Times News article in early August of 1990 said that Sanders was being overlooked no more. It even had quotes from his coach back at Limestone College. That was none other than legendary pitcher Gaylord Perry. Perry said that Tracy definitely had the tools to make it all the way to the major leagues.
They also still had five future major leaguers on the team. Pitchers Alan Embry, Steve Gajkowski, and Dave Malicki, and infielders David Bell and Jason Hartke. Hartke, a shortstop, signed late that summer, He actually signed on his high school graduation trip in Hawaii, which is why he showed up in Burlington in July. Monastero talked about how he was a little homesick when he first signed. Hartke, who was straight out of high school, also found it difficult to adjust.
Yeah, so one other memory that I had. So besides, you know, we had talked about Dave and, you know, I first got there and, you know, he was awesome. I mean, to have Dave as a first, you know, coach, first of all, when I got there, I was still calling everybody coach. And I remember I couldn't stop saying coach. And so he started calling me player. You know, he wouldn't call me Jason. He'd call me player. So I'm calling him. And that was the hardest habit to break, you know, when I first got there is get coach out of my head, call him Dave. You know, I kept calling him coach, coach, coach. And you know, I was probably doing it to Stan as well, calling him coach. You know, it's like, no, you know, and I was calling umpires blue and, you know, and you have to know, you got to call them by their name too.
They also still had one player we've not yet talked about in this podcast, someone who's probably deserving of their own podcast series. You can Google him. And there is absolutely nothing about him on the internet.
The great Arnie Oland.
Ashley, why don't you tell our listeners who that is?
Arnie Oland is a former minor league baseball player that I manufactured one day when kids were asking for autographs from the players, and somehow I got involved and they wanted my autograph. For some reason that I don't even know why the name came to me, I wrote the name Arnie Oland, and Arnie Oland was born.
You would have been in your Burlington Indians bat boy uniform, and kids came up asking for an autograph, maybe not even knowing your role with the team.
Yes, exactly. I'd probably just happened to be standing around, and they saw my baseball uniform and assumed I was on the team.
So there's a chance then that there are people out there to this very day with a signed baseball from the 1990 Burlington Indians team. And there's some great names on there, players like Jim Thome and Alan Embry. And that ball is probably worth something. But there, among all the names, I'm guessing there's a possibility that Arnie Oland's signature is on there too?
Yeah, there's a very good chance of that.
But even with all the talent on the team in August, and even with the fictional Arnie Oland, the Indians went 10-21 in the month of August. Their record at home was abysmal. They were 3-13 at home in that stretch. They even lost their last 8 games at home that season. They finished 35-37.
Elizabethton, which was full of players just out of college, won 20 in a row, and they finished 51-16.
But there were still plenty of highlights, or things we remember at least. We mentioned in episode 3 how Buddy Bell, the roving hitting instructor for the Indians, came to town that summer. Ashley, meeting him stands out in your mind?
It does. I was going into Keller's office for one reason or another before a game. And as I've mentioned before, you know, when I was talking about Frank, there was a chair across from Dave's desk, and I walked in, and none other than Buddy Bell was sitting in that chair. And I knew exactly who he was as soon as I saw him, having collected baseball cards as a kid. He said, "Hey, I'm Buddy," and extended his left hand for me to shake. And I will never forget that, because he probably thought it was pretty funny extending his left hand for me to shake. I thought it was pretty great to meet Buddy Bell, so win-win.
And no other words exchanged other than that?
Nope, not a single one.
Something else happened in August that radio announcer Andy Young still remembers decades later. In the summary that he prepared for us about that season, he had one entry for August 14th that, well, we'll let him explain it.
And I hope you can, I hope this isn't, it won't offend any families, but August 14th, I'm looking through my scorecards, but I know I'm not going to find one for August 14th because we were rained out. I think it was the only rain out of the summer. There might have been another one because there was a double, but we played a doubleheader on the 15th in Bristol. We didn't even go to the ballpark on the 14th. It was pouring down rain, teeming rain. And we had come in the night before. We'd been on the road in Pulaski. So we got to the hotel in Bristol, which is a standard two-story cinder block Scotchman Inn, or you know, something extremely economical. And as often happens, there was some, I think Marilyn Fried Chicken was down the street. Some kind of fried chicken was down the street, and a few of the braver people, you know, that had rain gear, ran and picked up chicken and whatever for everybody. So, anyways, we settle in. I would imagine there were probably we were in the hotel all night, nowhere to go. I was in a room with four or five guys playing either spades or hearts or poker, some sort of card game, and a lot of the I suspect that was just going on in a lot of different rooms. We'd been in the room for a while, and as often happened, there were two or three of the guys were chewing tobacco, and they'd spit cups there, and a lot of them had some fried chicken, and as is often the case with, I used to say young men, but just men in particular, there was a lot of gas being passed, and, you know, between that and the beer people were drinking, it probably was kind of nasty in there, but, you know, you're in there for a while, you get used to it. About, 10 o'clock or so, there's a knock at the door. I don't remember whose room it was, but whoever it was says, "Come on in, it's open." And Tracy Sanders comes in. He's got his ice bucket. He goes, "Hey, you guys got it?" He's about to ask for ice. He goes, "Hey, you guys got it?" And he wrinkles up his nose and he goes, "Oh, man. Oh, it smelled like a bucket ass in here." And that has become the bucket ass. That's become a favorite put down in a favorite expression in my family. If or any time somebody has some horrible fart or somebody hasn't bathed for a while, the standard line in my family has become, "Oh man, you smell like a bucket ass." and I have to give credit where credit's due. That came from Tracy Sanders of Dallas, North Carolina.
The 1990 team provided Andy with another saying that he remembers. It was from our friend Tony Tillman, the relief pitcher, who earned the nickname the Snake because he snaked wins away from starting pitchers who got pulled early. Anyway, here's Andy Young describing one night when the weather wasn't cooperating.
Actually, he was the guy one day where I came into the clubhouse and somebody says, "You think we'll play?" And that's when Tony Tillman came in with water dripping off me. He goes, "Boys, it's raining like a cow pissing on a flat rock." And next to bucket ass, that's like my next favorite expression that I learned from the boys.
And I remember a game, I think late in the season, Burlington was playing the Bluefield Orioles. Bluefield had a catcher named Greg Zahn. I was in the dugout near Alan Walden.
Alan Walden, by the way, was the team's number two starter in 1990. Keller said he was a country bumpkin from Cleveland, Tennessee.
Alan was probably not talking to me, but he was talking to somebody, and I overheard him say, "If something goes down tonight, I'm going after Greg Zahn." I think that always stuck out to me, mainly because Zahn went on to a pretty lengthy major league career. And it was funny, you know, at the time, because, you know, here they're talking about having a fight. It's just really stuck with me all these years.
And you actually talked to Greg Zahn recently, right?
I did, actually. Funny enough, I sent an email to his baseball academy, and he texted me probably a couple hours later and said, "Hey, this is Greg Zahn. Give me a call." So I called him, and we chatted for maybe, you know, 10, 12 minutes, and I was able to convey the story to him about what I heard from Alan Walden, and never thought I would get closure from Greg Zahn on this story all these years later, but I did.
How did Greg Zahn give you closure about that night?
Well, he acknowledged that he and his team were assholes, really. He was not surprised that there was some bad blood between the teams, and he, in his memory, he expected there was probably bad blood between Bluefield and most of the other teams in the league.
The last time the Indians played Bluefield at home, that was August 17th, 1990. That night, the 17th, I said goodbye to Roberto Jimenez. I told him I was heading off to college. I could tell the idea of college seemed pretty foreign to him because all he'd ever known was baseball. He put his arm around me, smiled a big smile, and he told me to study hard, to get A's, and to meet a lot of girls. Let's just say that.
And when you left, I actually took over on the camera, and that gave me another great memory from that summer. Do you remember the bat races?
Oh, yeah.
Burlington used to run a contest in the late innings called the bat races. They drew two contestants at random, and they stood near home plate. They put their foreheads on a bat and went around in a circle, maybe 10 times, until they were dizzy enough to try to run down to first base.
I'm pretty sure they don't do this anymore, for good reason.
Well, one night, college intern Dave Burke was one of the contestants.
Josh had gone back to school already, and so I was doing some of the filming of the batters and the pitchers.
Yeah.
And I believe it must have been one of the last few games because Coach Keller, he didn't really need the video, but I did it anyway so I could get paid. But I was filming, you know, some of the players, and I believe it was on that tape, and I still wish I had it, that you did the dizzy bat race. And I believe you'd been drinking a little bit. And all I remember is like you're going around in the circle around the bat, and then you stop and you clap your hands like
that's
three
right.
times.
But I didn't fall.
That's right.
But I didn't fall. I remember that. I stopped, clapped my hands, and you know, and ran straight forward. Yet, but I did not fall. I almost fell. That was probably one of my prouder moments.
I think some of these stories probably made the pain of all those August losses a little more bearable.
That's true, but there were some more team highlights despite their record. Starting pitchers Alan Embry and Alan Walden, who were 1-2 in the rotation, they each started 15 games that season. That's impressive for a short season. It even set a team record. The league record is 16 starts, so they just missed that.
Embry and Walden were also among the league leaders in earned run averages.
Tracy Sanders hit 10 home runs, which was just two behind what Tomey had hit. Sanders also tied Tomey for the team lead in RBIs with 34. Tomey, by the way, finished third in the league for home runs, even though he got sent up a month before the season ended.
And Tony Tillman, the Snake, he led the team in wins with 7. A reliever led the team in wins. Tillman was also named the team's most popular player.
Yeah, but I can't believe that team ended 35-37 and lost their last 8 games at home. What a way to end a season. And no matter what the record was, the players were definitely disappointed that the season came to an end. Remember how summer camp ended? Here's Mike Pincus describing pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, I remember Walden. I mean, I just remember spending a lot of time with Alan and Tilly and Tomey. And I remember us always saying, man, we're going to keep in touch forever, man. We got to always, you know, stay in touch. And I remember we all like exchanged numbers, you know, after the season was over. And I remember feeling like this, like loss. Like I was like really bummed when I left Burlington that year, just because of the bond that you form with guys, and you know, you just don't know what's going to happen next and where anybody's going to go.
Ashley, you've got your own special memory of how the season ended.
I do. It involved Dave Burke. He rented the upstairs of a home that summer. He had no AC and he lost 20 pounds. Andy Young, the radio announcer, lived downstairs. Their house was just down the street from our high school. By the end of the season, I was back in school. Seniors got to go off campus for lunch, so I ventured down to see Dave one day.
And you probably don't remember this, but before you left town, I think you were leaving soon, and I can't remember dates or anything, but I was already back in school, and you know the high school was right up the street from that house.
Yeah, that's right.
I walked down at lunch one day. And I told you I was coming, you know, and yep. I'm like, I'm banging on the door. No, Dave, keep banging on the door. And I, you know, you finally came and let me in. And I believe I had a piece of bologna and a beer for lunch.
We had to keep it simple back then.
Exactly.
Yeah, see, I was a bad influence all the way back then. Thank you.
slice of bologna and a beer and a lonely walk back to school. That's how the 1990 season ended.
But back to the hot dogs. Josh and I still can't make heads or tails of Frank's story. His version of events must have occurred earlier in the season, and our event occurred later. That might explain why it was a really big deal. This was a second time. But Frank didn't remember anything like that, though.
Maybe he's blocked out a second event. He never said it didn't happen. He said he didn't remember.
As for whether it had anything to do with Frank getting sent down, Dave Keller says probably not.
Nope. You got to remember that it doesn't matter, and I think it's still the same now. Guys are moved up and down because of how they play. There's very, very rare occasion when those guys will get moved up or down because of disciplinary reasons or any of that kind of stuff.
If this was the rare event that did cause someone to get sent down, we like to think that Frank would probably remember it.
Here's where we need to tell you about a game that we didn't know about when we started this project. It was a road game, and it was Frank's last game with Burlington. The Indians were playing the red-hot Elizabethton Twins. It seems highly relevant to the main question that we've been trying to answer in our podcast.
To set it up, you need to know about the infield position Frank was most comfortable with.
What would you say, you know, from a, you know, when you were in college and your year pro, what position were you most comfortable playing?
Second base. Easily second base, because I was always labeled as above average speed, but an average arm. And I remember my first professional ball is a lot faster than college ball, as you can imagine. I remember my first ground ball being hit to me while I was playing short. The guy who hit it, I threw him out by half a step. That was it. And it was a routine ground ball. So I had to be flawless as an infielder to play short. My arm was plenty strong enough for to play second base, and I had enough range. My range was pretty good to cover the ground at second base, but my range was good to cover the shortstop ground, but my arm, I didn't have a professional shortstop arm. You could put me there in an emergency, but you can't play short with an average arm at that level. It's got to be above average.
But late in his time with the Burlington Indians, Frank took on a new position.
I got drafted as a second baseman, so I played some games there at second base. I was flip-flopping back and forth. In the beginning of that season, that's when Tommy was there. Jimbo was playing third. So then when Jimbo got called up, then I became the everyday third baseman.
So here's Andy Young on Frank's final game in Burlington, July 31st, 1990. Frank Monastero was playing third. Mike Pincus was playing first.
Okay, what turned out to be his last game came on Tuesday the 31st of July at Joe O'Brien Field in Elizabethton, Tennessee. The Indians were 25-15 coming into the game, which is a pretty good record, but they had started fast. Jim Thome had been called up, so they were starting to hit the skids a little bit, and they're coming in to play the best team in the league. The Twins are 28-8, and they've won 11 in a row. For a while there, it looked like the stars were going to align perfectly. Mike Pincus hit a three-run homer in the top of the first inning. Miguel Flores hit a two-run homer in the second, and the Indians got two more runs in the top of the fourth. They're beating this best team in the league 7-0 at the end of 3.5. Alan Embry was living a charmed life. He pitched the first three innings scoreless. He walked four guys, but he got two double play grounders in that inning. The magic ran out in the bottom of the fourth. The Twins got three runs and chased Embry. But at that point, Tony Tillman came in and pretty much slammed the door. In fact, Pincus hit another home run in the top of the seventh. So a seventh inning stretch time. The Elizabethan winning streak is in serious jeopardy. It's 7-3 in favor of the visitors. But in the bottom of the seventh, the Twins get a run off of Tony Tillman. It was an unearned run because of an error by the second baseman. In the bottom of the eighth, they got another run that scored on Frank's error. ground ball to third that he threw away. That came with one out and brought in Paul Russo. So now it's getting a little tight. The score is now 8-5. Top of the ninth, the Indians go out. They get three runs in the bottom of the ninth to tie the game 8-8. Top of the 10th, Frank has a chance to be a hero. He comes up with two out, runner at first base, but grounds into a forced play. And it ended up, it was quite a night for Frank at the plate. Five at-bats. He was batting ninth, playing in the third base. He grounded to short in the second, reached on an error by the shortstop in the fourth, grounded to short in the sixth, grounded to short in the eighth, and grounded into a 6-4 forced play in the 10th. So five at-bats, five ground balls to shortstop in what turned out to be his last Appalachian League game. It's 8-8, bottom of the 10th. Sam Baker's in to pitch, gets rid of the first batter. Actually, he gets rid of the first two batters. Then he hits Rich Becker with a pitch. Next batter up is John Gumpf. He grounds the third, and Frank throws it down the right field line. It's a three-base error. Winning run scores. That was the 31st. The next night, Twins beat the Indians again, 4-3. Thursday morning, we get back to Burlington, and that Frank will probably tell you the time better, but that afternoon they told him the bad news. He was being sent down to the Gulf Coast League, where, as it turned out, he finished his career.
When the kids at his academy ask him for some stories, this is one that Frank tells them.
And I tell this story, too, to the kids, too, because, you know, this is a game of failure, okay? I mean, you fail, that's how you learn. I had a walk-off error against the Twins at third base. And I remember Pincus coming to me after the game apologizing because I think I overthrew the bag. I think it was two outs. We were up one, routine ground ball hit to me, and I airmailed it. Game over. So that was my only walk-off error ever, and it had to come at that level.
After playing in 21 games and batting 151, Frank Monastero never played another game for Burlington.
Dave came to me and said, the organization wants you to learn more positions. They want you to play. They want you to play every day. They want you to learn third base, short, and second. And I was doing that at Burlington, but it wasn't like every day. So that's when he had said, you know, they're going to send you down Florida and they're going to have you, you know, you're going to play every single day. And it's going to be either third base, it's either going to be a shortstop, or it's either going to be at second.
Frank played well down in Florida. He hit 300 and he improved at third base. That season ended and Frank was left to wait and see what the next year might bring.
Yeah, I got a late notice in the mail about being released. And I think I remember Dave was a little upset about it. He felt that I shouldn't have gotten released. And I remember, you know, Dave saying to me that I don't understand. I'll look into it. You shouldn't have been released. I put up some half decent numbers. So that's why I think Dave was shocked. And I'm glad somebody like Dave was in my corner. Like I said, I got along well with Dave. And he reached out. I remember him reaching out saying, you know, you shouldn't have been released. I don't know why they're releasing you now in November. If you did get released, it was in October. So I don't know if I was like on the butcher block or, you know what they were. But I got my notice in the mail towards the end of November.
Frank was definitely at a loss to understand why he'd been cut.
Did you ever get any explanation?
No, I just assumed I didn't play well enough. I mean, that's how it works at that level, at the professional level.
Frank Monastero still believed that he had what it took to make it in professional baseball, and he didn't stop trying.
I went down to a Bucky Dent camp for released players that he hosted a week-long camp for those guys. And there was a couple organizations interested, but nothing. Nothing happened.
And just like that, the professional baseball career of Frank Monastero came to an end. In our next episode, we'll tell you what became of some of the Burlington Indians we've discussed in this podcast. And we'll tell you what became of Frank.
A few listeners told us that they appreciated hearing about the contraction in episode 4. They said it was a rather grim subject, but they liked how we left them with some hope.
That's how we want to leave episode 5. the story of Frank Monastero definitely gets better.
You'll hear about all of that and more on the next episodes of the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs.
If you're enjoying the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs, be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're getting your podcasts. Recommend us to a friend or give us a shout out on social media. These kinds of things help us get found, and we definitely appreciate it.
And be sure to check out the band Cabinet. They've been so kind to lend us their library for use in our podcast. It wouldn't be the same without them. Find them online at cabinetmusic.com and on Facebook and Instagram at Cabinet Music.
And thank you for listening to the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs. We'll see you next time.
Oh, when you're young, when you were so sweet, oh, nobody could compete with your smile, when your smile shines like the sun.